from WABE in Atlanta. This is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for joining us. This is our daily look at arts and culture and the good they can do for the spirit of Atlanta. Today, we're talking with some of the creative team behind the Bronze Lands Film Festival, which hopes to bring more attention to this city as a center of film production for people of color. And first this hour, Hinduism and Holst join forces. Kennesaw State University kicks off their Year of India programming this weekend with a unique event, a rarely performed one-act opera by Gustav Holst, featuring perhaps the oldest form of South Indian classical dance. We're going to learn more about all of this with Todd Wedge. He's an assistant professor of voice at Kennesaw, alongside choreographer Rivka Mayoni and KSU vocal student DeAndrea West. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Let's start with the story of Savitri. What is the essential story?
The story really talks about a young lady who is born to King Ashwapati, who is a very powerful king of the Madura kingdom. The king doesn't have any children and sits down to pray to the sun god, performing a puja or a prayer ceremony with fire. And then he meditates for a very long time and is blessed with a beautiful daughter, Savitri. Savitri grows up to be a very beautiful and pure young lady who, through her time with her father, becomes very, very, very special to him like any daughter. Time comes for marriage, and she does not have a good suitor, because she's so beautiful. So she tells her father not to worry. She's going to go out and look for a suitor herself. She makes her way out into the lands and stops at a forest where her eyes fall upon Satyavan, who is the son of a blind king who has lost his kingdom, and they now live in the forest. Satyavan is known for his generosity, and he's extremely handsome. Savitri is smitten. That's the man she wants. So here she comes back home and speaks to her father, the king, and asks to be married to Satyavan. The king, of course, is not happy about this decision. This is a penniless prince living in a forest. But more than that, he has heard from the saint, Narada Muni, that Satyavan only has 1 year to live. Oh. So the father, of course, is not willing to give his precious daughter away to somebody who has such a short life. Savitri is insistent. She's smitten. She wants Satyavan. Finally, her father gives in, and marriage ceremonies are held with all the pomp and grandeur that are befitting a princess. Savitri gets herself ready to leave in the forest, to follow her husband there and live with him. And during that time that she's preparing, Satyavan and the father-in-law, the king, sit down for a wonderful game of dice and some bonding and camaraderie. Savitri finally comes all ready with her bags and all her belongings to head into the forest. The king, with a very bitter heart, very saddened heart, sends his daughter away at that point. And so here they leave into the forest. Satyavan picks flowers along the way for his beautiful new bride, shows her the birds in the forestry, picks up wonderful, delicious fruits along the way, and they enjoy this year together.
Now, the opera begins not with Savitri's origin story.
That is correct. So what we've done is we've created this ballet, like a prelude to bring in the story of Savitri, to showcase to our audience what happens before that time where the opera brings in the latter part.
So there must be a rather extensive narrative ballet that you've created to tell this story.
It is. I think it's about 20, 25 minutes with three wonderful dancers who narrate the story through.
Ah. Rivka, let's talk about the opening dance, this 20, 25-minute ballet you've choreographed. It's in the South Indian classical dance form Bharatanatyam?
That is correct.
What does that look like?
Bharatanatyam is one of India's oldest Indian classical forms of dance. The lines and the movements are extremely precise. When I'm talking to our students here, I normally tell them, compare it to ballet. The form, just like plié, the dancers sit at that same level. There's a lot of rhythmic movement with the feet, eye movement, body and hand gestures. So what I have been able to do in this choreography is bring together some rhythmic movements, or jatis as they are called, intertwined with abhinaya, or facial expressions and hand gestures, where we tell the story that I just narrated.
Are the movements more angular than rounded? I guess I'm just going by pictures I've seen, and they seem very stylized, but more angular. On the other hand, that could just be because of the way they're drawn.
Well, no, you're right, Luis. The Bharatanatyam dancers have very precise linings. Everything has a certain angle, a certain form, and they're very crisp in the way that they're demonstrated. So you're exactly right.
The art was well drawn. Now, was it difficult to teach this very special form of dance, this ancient revered form of dance, to Western students?
It was a little challenging, but I'm going to say I've been very blessed. The students from the Department of Dance at Kennesaw State University are some of the finest dancers that I've had the privilege to teach. These dancers come from different styles that they're honed in on, whether it's ballet, modern, or contemporary. Bringing them in, it took a little bit getting them used to more of the hand gestures, because Western dance doesn't use as many hastas or mudras, which are specific hand gestures that denote a specific meaning. We struggled at that. But as far as rhythm was concerned, as far as poise, the look, these were just beautiful dancers. And so it was easy to work through those pieces. And once they got used to the storyline, they were just excited to move forward. And with our practices, I've started putting them into saris, which is the way I would normally practice when I'm rehearsing. So they're in character all the time. So they've learned how to drape a sari, and they come in and they practice just like you would see anybody in India.
Well, dance certainly has pride of place at Kennesaw, as does voice. Todd, what makes this particular opera unique?
I think probably that it's by Gustav Holst. A composer who we certainly know the planets, we certainly know all of the orchestral music very well, but he's not well known as a voice composer, and he had sort of a rough go at it. You know, like a lot of composers in that period, they had a sort of Indian period, and he certainly did as well. He was very versed in Sanskrit. In fact, he translated the text of this opera himself, and also of interest, he was working for about 5 years on a project of Sita, which is an opera that was 5 hours long, not well received, never performed, and actually quoted as being sort of watered down Wagner. interestingly enough. And then years after he sort of got over the burn of that, he did start, he wrote of Savitri. And that's where I think he really hit his stride. And it's sad that he didn't continue. But it's really beautiful. There are moments of, he certainly borrows from Indian scales. He certainly learned a lot from Wagner. There's moments where you can tell the writing is the same, but because it's a chamber opera, it's more appropriate for younger voices.
Let's listen to the opera's opening here. It starts with the voice of death in the distance, summoning Satyavan.
Summoning Savitri. He's coming in and letting her know that today is the day. This is a voice that she's been hearing in her dreams, and it's been getting louder and louder and louder. And today the opera starts with no accompaniment. It's completely a cappella and very haunting and very creepy.
and magical. Yeah.
And so he's letting her know that today, in fact, is the day that he is going to take her husband.
Of dread, day or night, they never leave me. Once in dreams I heard them, but now they rob me of sleep and give instead the gloom of ghostly fears and dreadful bodies. Within the house, that voice of warning lurks in every temple, it enshrouds me until the song of thousands is to me a thing of naught.
We heard the illustrious Dame Janet Baker in that portion from Savitri. Was the opening. You mentioned it was there is an a cappella opening, and I should add, for many of you who may already know, Todd Wedge was a member of Chanticleer for a while. Speaking of a cappella.
Very familiar.
you certainly earned your cred. If you are just joining us, we're with members from Kennesaw State University's production of Savitra. Todd Wedge, assistant professor of voice at Kennesaw State, also directing their production of Holst's opera Savitri, choreographer Rivka Mayani, and KSU vocal student DeAndrea West, whom we'll hear from in just a moment, on City Lights.
Support for WABE comes from Nissan of Noonan. Nissan of Noonan, a fresh approach to the car buying experience. Their number is 844-FRESH-15. Online at nissanofnoonan.com. And from Renewal Design Build, providing kitchen and open floor plan renovations for InTown Atlanta. Your home, your life renewed. More information at renewaldesignbuild.com.
Back with members of the opera Savitri to be performed at Kennesaw State University. DeAndrea, you have the title role. Have you ever performed anything like this before?
I've been a part of the KSU opera program for the past four semesters, but anything like this, no, I have not. This has been very unique and very interesting.
How did you prepare?
It was very challenging. He gave us the role before we let out for the summer, so I had 2 to 3 months, roughly 2 months to get this together, get it all in my voice, memorized, all notes, you know, known. So when we came back, we could hit the ground running. And this summer I had two jobs. So it was very, very interesting making sure I had enough discipline and consistency to get everything done by the time. So it helped me professionally grow up.
This is very different from, okay, it's summer vacation and now I'm back at school and this is what we're going to do. You got your marching orders before summer vacation.
I did.
But it sounds like it was a very enriching experience.
It was very enriching.
Are there any aspects of Safi-Tri you admire or might even identify with?
Well, I'm 20 years old and I am a college student. Of course, I have no husband, but I identify with it being life. I would say that the things that she went through as far as like emotional and stuff, you can apply that with life. And, you know, life goes through a lot of emotions. Sometimes you have to let things go. But at the end of the day, you will live and you will be victorious.
She was very determined and very intelligent and very beautiful.
Yeah.
Why do you think Savitri is so seldom performed, Todd?
You know, double bills can be tricky. I think that one of the things that makes this interesting is you really need to honor the certain parts of the culture that can be hard to do if you double bill it with something else. You know, it really stands alone. There's not a ton of Western opera that references Hindu characters or Hindu stories. So to find a pairing with that, you could certainly use one of the other Holst one acts, Wandering Scholar and things like that. That'll be done. But even that has nothing to do with Hindu culture or Indian culture. And so it's like a little corner by itself. And, you know, having, like we mentioned earlier, the beginning and the end actually are completely sung with just voice. It's completely a cappella. There's no accompaniment. And so I think that could be one of the reasons as well. And again, I think Holst just isn't really well known for being a writer of vocal music, which is why we're doing this.
Yeah. Let's talk about Holst's treatment of what is Indian. I mean, this was written during the empire, the height of the empire. Yep. India was
1908. Yeah,
the jewel in the crown. Was he mimicking or even appropriating so-called Indian music, which is so diverse? I mean,
right.
Just to even say
sure.
Indian music doesn't convey it accurately. Is he respectful? I mean, how would you assess it?
That is a great question, because appropriation is certainly something that Holst alone wasn't guilty of. You know, I think in general, a lot of English composers were maybe guilty of that a little bit, but we do have this lush music, which is really incredible, and I think he was very respectful. We have, I think Rivka would agree with that too.
I do.
Satyavan's music is really that moment where we hear the Indian scale come in. But other than that, you can fully call this Western music, absolutely. Holst did go beyond other composers because he was obsessed with Sanskrit and he was interested in the nitty gritty of the culture, not just the superficial, you know, scales and just overall timbres and soundscapes. He really did go further, and he was reading poetry, and he was looking at real South Indian art.
And we do know from his Western music that he was very interested in mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
So this element of mysticism, the thread through Hindu culture, would appeal to him, understandably.
Yeah. And right after this, we should say that right after this opera was written, it was kind of when he went, sort of left his Indian period and went into the stars and the, where he became obsessed with constellations and things in space and the universe.
And was fascinated with astrology,
yeah.
Although maintained it was more scientific than what we know of as, who knows? who knows? We had this eclipse yesterday and a bunch of things.
It's good timing, isn't
funny.
It?
Yeah. Yeah. DeAndrea, what have you learned from singing this music? Singing and the dances and playing Savitri?
I have learned a whole bunch about the culture. It has really, Professor Riftka has taught me so much in learning how to put on the sari and all this stuff. So I've learned a bunch about the culture, which is very enlightening to the to my performance career and everything else.
I think maybe one day you'll visit India.
Yes, yes,
truly.
I have to.
A great kickoff for Kennesaw's Year of India. I guess in the little bit of time we have left, the minute or so we have left, Todd and Rivka, do you think this is an ideal opera for students?
I personally think it's going to be such a beautiful experiential moment for our students and the community. It really sets off in a wonderful way the tone for the Year of India at KSU, brings together our community and showcases the collaboration between East meets West. Mm-hmm. And truly, I'm grateful to Todd for bringing me on this journey with him.
It's my pleasure. I think that not only is the music beautiful, and as a musician, you can just wrap yourself in this texture of the music. But as an educator, there's so many teachable moments. We've got feminism. We've got a lot of cultural inclusion. There's so much to learn from this. Not just sing pretty music. You can learn where this text came from, and there's just a lot of really rich.
I think even adding
teaching.
In just the costumes that the students are going to be wearing, I took a little bit of a different path. When you normally have Bharatanatyam performed, it is performed to Carnatic music. And to bring in the north and the south of India, we actually have musicians from the northern part of India on a sarod, the dholak and tabla. So we blended in threads of India through this as well. And the students have been experiencing this and actually enjoying, and they'll stand by the musicians listening to the different chords that they're playing.
So we have inclusiveness within India in the global sense as well. I think the students are very fortunate to have you as director, Todd
Extremely
Wedge.
Thank you.
Extremely.
She's just trying to get an A.
Todd is directing KSU's production of Savitri by Gustav Holst. Rivka Mayani is the choreographer, and Kennesaw State student DeAndrea West sings the role of Savitri. The performances are Friday and Saturday night at 8 and Sunday afternoon at 3. We'll have more information on our website, wabe.org/City Lights. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you.
Having us.
Support for WABE comes from the 31st Annual Marietta Art in the Park Festival, including work from more than 175 artists. No tickets needed for this family-friendly way to spend Labor Day weekend. ArtParkMarietta.com. And from the High Museum of Art. Only weeks left to see prints by iconic pop artist Andy Warhol. Over 250 works on display, including Marilyn Monroe, Jacqueline Kennedy, and Campbell's soup cans. Tickets at high.org.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. Ja'Kai Mickelson and Omar Beach have been friends for more than 25 years. In high school, they'd do normal teenager things like play basketball and cruise around San Diego with a camcorder in hand. But unlike most teens, Omar often found himself in the hospital. He has sickle cell anemia, and in 2012, Ja'Kai had an idea to turn Omar's experiences into a documentary called Spilled Milk. It's premiering at the Bronze Lens Film Festival this year. Producer Gabby Watt spoke with Jakai and Omar back in April of 2015 while the film was still a work in progress.
For no particular reason at all, in high school, I was addicted to having a camcorder. So I had all this old footage of us, and that struck me as like, oh man, that could suddenly have a use. And shortly after is when I pitched the idea to Omar.
And I've said to many people, like, I didn't really have interest in doing the movies, but because he asked me for a multitude of reasons, I said yes, because A, I know he's talented, I know he'll get it done, he's a very driven person, I know he's got the eye to do it, and he's had a camera up in my face for 20 years also. I'll do it because the project is better than me. So I'm ultimately glad he brought it up.
What is sickle cell disease or sickle cell anemia specifically?
You wanna give it a shot, filmmaker?
I will speak behalf of the star of the film. Sickle cell is a genetic mutation, a blood disease. And basically what it means in short is your cells are shaped like sickles. They're shaped like
crescent moons.
Yeah, exactly. And what that means is they're not carrying enough oxygen and nutrients through the blood system. And it also means that, like puzzle pieces, they'll get locked up in kind of smaller veins and vessels.
Yeah, they catch on to each other, causes severe pain, and over time it kind of starts destroying the area where it gets caught up.
It's kind of an interesting disease in that, like, you know, it's not one that you kind of get sick and then you fight and then you get better. It's kind of a disease where you have good days and bad days. Naively, when I first jumped in on this thing, I seriously thought I was going to come out to Atlanta, stay with a friend, get all the footage I'd need for 2 months, interview Omar, hang out, go back to Los Angeles, edit it, and get it finished in 7 months. Yeah, that was 2012, but it's been an amazing journey. And the other thing is, like, when I approached this film, I never intended it for to be, you know, it didn't really start as a thing like, oh, well, let's get sickle cell out there. It started more as like, this is a really interesting story to tell, and let's start there. And weirdly, kind of all the advocacy and everything that's come from it has been a nice side effect.
With a lot of documentaries, you'll have the filmmaker, and the filmmaker can exert his or her view on the subject in certain ways without being physically present in the film, but both of you now are both subjects and both filmmakers, or at least, Omar, you're also doing editing, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm more like a backseat driver. Jakai does the great majority of the work. For the most part, I'm the guy on camera, but he is my friend. I think we trust each other's opinions well enough that if I say something, it'll be taken into consideration.
Well, it's been kind of like, because I think traditionally, you know, in a documentary, you've got filmmakers and subject, and they observe, and they're not necessarily involved in it. And I'd be lying to you if I said that hasn't been an insane challenge in all of this, because there's been times, seriously, you know, I look forward to this movie being done so him and I can just hang out again, because there's so many times he'll say something, and I'm like, why am I not rolling on this? That was a really good soundbite. So you become obsessed by it. And also, just given my perspective on things, I think it's super important. When we did a fundraiser, and one of the first things I did was hire an editor, because I felt like it was super important to have an outside perspective. And I've been super involved in the editorial process, you know, getting my hands dirty with the actual files and everything. But it's also super important to have somebody that doesn't know us to come in, because when it's all said and done, nobody's going to care about sickle cell if nobody cares about the story. So at the core of it, hopefully, it's something that people would want to watch without already having their sickle cell advocacy hat on. The whole thing has been a complete mind melt, and it's presented a lot of challenges that I didn't anticipate.
Like what?
Oh, gosh.
Well, I mean, just give a few.
I'm one of the problems.
Well, it's true, because, you know, you sign up for this, and like I said, naively, I thought at the beginning, I'm just going to be hanging out with Omar, you know, and it's going to be fun. But for the last 10 years, really, since he's lived out here and I've been out west, whenever we saw each other, it was kind of a highlight. When you hear Omar's in the hospital, you're like, ah, man, he's in the hospital again. And it almost becomes part of the nomenclature. But then when you're there with him a lot and you see what he's actually going through, being that close to it has been really difficult. And sometimes I'm like, really, Jakai, you didn't see this coming, huh? You just thought this was going to be fun. So And I'm sure Omar sometimes, well, I don't want to speak for him, but.
Well, yeah, Omar was a difficult when you're going through, because even in the trailer, at least, there are bouts where you look like you're in extreme pain. So I imagine having a camera there isn't necessarily helping that.
I mean, one of the main problems is I'm in there and I'm sick, and I have director Jakai instead of friend Jakai. Friend Jakai can take me out of my mind state. But director Jakai is focused on the sickness that's happening in there, the pain crisis. So then it kind of makes you more in the hospital, whereas friend Jakai would kind of take you out of it.
It's been kind of crazy. People ask, hey man, what's your next project going to be? And sometimes even in the hospital, people have like, when we've had interviews and stuff with doctors, someone will come up and be like, hey, there's this other small disease that nobody knows about. And I'm just like, if I ever do this again, it's going to be the happiest, most cuddly documentary you've ever seen. It's going to be about like something that can't have a downside.
With the film, a lot of it is addressing the stigma against the disease. So could you talk a little bit about what that stigma is?
Well, for me, it was actually something that I discovered in the making of this film. I never considered it before. And Omar mentioned it just kind of nonchalantly in an interview once, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, but I didn't really think much about it. But the more and more that we've learned, it's a super serious problem. I mean, one of the things I ran into a lot with sickle cell is people were like, oh, that's that black disease. And statistically, that's true, but it affects, I mean, sickle cell kind of came to exist because it was a defense mechanism against malaria. So it comes from the places where malaria was right. An issue.
It's an African-born disease.
Exactly. It's a snowball effect into a larger conversation about like the racial tension in this country and equality of healthcare and everything else. I mean, sickle cell is a disease that requires a lot of pain medication. If I tried to take what Omar takes to avert a crisis, I'm pretty sure I'd be done. But he's got a lifetime of using that stuff, so obviously he's got a pretty high tolerance.
And part of the problem is having a high tolerance and also dealing with the disease for your whole life. You can look like you're not in a massive amount of pain while you are, but to like medical staff, if they don't see your pain, they don't necessarily believe it. So like there was a time when I was in the hospital with a bunch of people who go to the same doctors I do. We've sort of made a community. And one night we were all just sitting in a room together because there was like four of us admitted at the same time. And we were kind of just joking around a little bit because you got to learn how to laugh during that sort of thing. What actually ended up happening, though, is multiple medical staff saw us in there joking around and stuff like that. And even though we're in pain, they didn't believe it. And we were all discharged the next morning because they felt like that they're not in pain, they're laughing. And sometimes they don't see the pain, but they just see you taking the medicine. So they think you're just there for basically to get high. If I wanted to get high, I could stay home. I'm at a hospital because I can't maintain myself at home at this point. The invisibility of it and the way that we can make it invisible to ourselves, it breeds disbelief.
We haven't really talked about like how painful it is, but in one of the interviews, a doctor talks about like this 3-year-old girl who clearly broke her arm. Her family didn't bring her to the hospital right away because she wasn't making as much fuss about her arm as she would a sickle cell crisis. So, I mean, that kind of gives you some perspective. Pain is subjective, but that gives you some perspective on just what kind of pain we're talking about here.
And I've asked some of the girls who have it, and a lot of them say it's more painful than childbirth. So it's pretty painful. In my head, I'm like, if you don't learn to laugh, you don't learn to take yourself out of the pain, and you do it for as long as I've done it, you would probably drive yourself insane.
Why is the title of the film Spilled Milk?
You know, I met Omar. He's older than me. And obviously now I'm 37, he's 40. But when we were in high school, he was a big brother for me. And he's been a guy that's given me tons of advice. And he's played a huge role in me becoming who I am. But I'd always spend time kind of wishing, like, gosh, what could Omar be if he didn't have this disease? Like, what has this disease gotten in the way of for him? But sometimes it's like, you know, he still had an amazing impact on my life, and you got to be thankful for that. So there's no reason to cry over the spilled milk. We kind of arrived at the title together. I know people are always thrown off by it, but it's kind of optimistic. And I think, you know, I'd rather have Omar in my life as is than not at all.
And like, even with all of it, you know, a lot of people think it's a miserable life, but it's not. I feel very fortunate. But the way I do is to stay optimistic and don't dwell on it. Just let's get to tomorrow and it will start over again. So why cry?
Producer Gabby Watts spoke with Ja'Kai Nicholson and Omar Beach. Their documentary, Spilled Milk, will screen at the 8th Annual Bronze Lens Film Festival this Friday at the Westin Peachtree Plaza. That takes place at noon. And in just a moment, we'll hear more about this year's Bronze Lens Film Festival with its executive producer, Kathleen Bertrand, and filmmaker, Melina Cunningham Anderson. This is City Lights on WABE.
Support for WABE comes from BARC, helping to keep your children safer online by monitoring their text messaging, social media, and email accounts without infringing on their privacy. Learn more at BARC.us. BARC. Monitor. Detect. Alert. And from Children's Museum of Atlanta, presenting Blue Man Group Making Waves through September 4th. You can discover the art and science behind music during this multi-sensory exploration of sound. Grandparent memberships available. ChildrensMuseumAtlanta.org.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. The Bronze Lens Film Festival is in its 8th year, along with screenings of films from around the country focusing on African-American stories and filmmakers. Bronze Lens honors industry leaders and hosts panels, master classes, and luncheons. We have Bronze Lens executive producer Kathleen Bertrand in studio with us, along with local filmmaker and journalist Melina Cunningham Anderson. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. Thank you.
Kathleen, a lot of people in Atlanta know you as a jazz singer. How did you end up founding and executive producing Bronze Lens?
Wow. Well, yes, they do know me as a jazz singer, but I've always done my music in conjunction with my day job. And at the time, I was Senior Vice President of Community and Governmental Affairs at the Atlanta Convention and Visitors Bureau. I had a 32-year career there. And while there, the idea of a film festival that really highlighted African-American achievement was conceived by my CEO, William Pate, who said, why don't we do something like this in Atlanta? Because when I'm in Sundance, there's people all over the place, everybody knows about it. And I don't know that people really know that about Atlanta yet. And Georgia at the time was really starting to take off. We were 6th in the country in film and television production back in 2009 when these discussions first started. And so it was key that we have been able to grow the festival as Georgia's reputation as a film and television production destination has likewise grown. And we always talked about making Atlanta the destination for film and television production for people of color. That was one of the things that we started off with early on, so that people would really have a great understanding that there were so many opportunities here that were growing with this industry. So come to Bronze Lens, see great content by people from all over the country, and learn a little bit about Atlanta at the same time.
This year, Bronze Lens is an Oscar-qualifying festival film festival in the short films category.
Yes, we're very excited about that.
How do you go about securing that qualification?
I don't know. We got a call.
You just got it. That came to you.
We got a call, an email actually, that we were being looked at. And we had a lot of things that we had to do from a paperwork perspective, recommendations. There is really quite an extensive process. And so we were able to do the work and be a part of the process. And I think it certainly was helpful that we had two Academy members that wrote our letters of recommendation, because we've had a number of people that have been a part of Bronze Lens that know what we try to do. And we got word right before Christmas. It was a great Christmas gift.
I would think.
Yes.
Milena, your film in the festival is Little Music Man Child.
Yes.
How did you meet the central character, Malik Kofi?
It's an interesting story, Lois. I actually met this young man by accident. A friend of mine was having a fundraising event for him in Birmingham, Alabama, which is where I lived at the time. They were raising money because this is an inner city child who needed funds to be able to go to a music festival, and they were trying to raise at least $2,000. The event was happening right before Christmas. I was trying to pack to get home to visit my family in South Carolina, and I thought, wow, I really don't have time to go, but because they're friends of mine, let me just sneak in, write the check, and leave. Well, as luck would have me, they had me seated right down front.
I couldn't sneak out.
And this child comes in. He's barely 5 foot tall, about the same size as his instrument. And as soon as he opened his mouth and started to speak, I was struck. And being a journalist, I paid attention, because this was not your typical child at any age. And then when he sat down to play the cello, I was even more mesmerized, because he played it like a man. And it just popped in my head, look at this little man child. And the idea was born for a documentary. His grandmother was there who raised him. And I asked her, could I just follow them for a week? I just was curious about his life. So after the holidays, she got back with me. 1 week turned into several months, and a documentary was born.
Sounds like December is a good month for both of you. Santa comes early and delivers well.
Yes.
I love the name of your production company, Milena.
Thank you.
News Lady Productions.
Yes.
From your anchoring and journalism background, do you feel like you get to flex your creative muscle with documentary form?
Absolutely, because as a news lady, and particularly when I was an anchor and reporter, I was one of those anchors and reporters. I covered hard news. I covered crime and I covered politics. Nothing pretty about that at all. Occasionally, I would come across a good story, but in the news business, unfortunately, that doesn't sell. It's not sexy enough. But I always wanted to be able to tell those stories. And the documentary form gives me that. And it has started with Malik, because as I was following him, I looked at, here is an inner city child, African-American, low income. People would look at this as negatives and probably would have given a negative bent to his story. But I looked at it as a diamond in the rough. This is a child born into circumstances, but the circumstances weren't him. And he was rising above, and he had a grandmother who, as you'll see in the film, is very tenacious. She does whatever it takes to get him what he needs to be the great musician that he is. And by the way, Malik is 16 now.
How did Malik discover the cello?
He discovered the cello, and it comes out in the film. He has older brothers who were twins, and he used to go with the grandmother to lessons with the twins. He was 5 years old at the time and told the grandmother, I can do that. I want to play. And she got him a cello. And she says in the film, from the time he started playing, it was never noise.
So the older brothers also studied cello.
They studied cello. They are 10 years older than Malik, 10 or 12 years older than Malik. But they weren't as good as he is. He's a natural. He's a prodigy. They were good, but they knew that wasn't them. And looking back, they wish now they had worked as hard as Malik, but they recognize he's a different kind of talent.
I see. Obviously, not everyone can be a prodigy. But what do you hope Bronze Lens audiences will take away from the film?
I hope they'll be inspired. When I was watching this child, because I spent so much time with him, especially when he was being homeschooled by his grandmother, who never went to college, I thought, wow, here I am in my, and I hate to give away my age, but I was in my 50s at the time, and I was thinking, I don't even know what they're talking about. And I have a college degree. And this is an 11-year-old child with a grandmother who never went to college. And at 11, what was I doing, you know? So I think it will inspire people, hopefully, to think about what are you doing with your life? What gifts and talents are buried within you, no matter what your station is in life? And what could you be doing better, no matter what your age?
We have a clip of Malik talking. Actually, he gave a TED Talk, and we're going to listen to this, Malik Kofi. Listening to a music excerpt from a TED Talk presentation that Malik Kofi was part of. There is a documentary screening about Malik at the Bronze Lens Festival this weekend. We'll hear more about it after a short break on WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from Capital One. You can open a Capital One savings account and discover more about Capital One savings online at capitalone.com/reimagineatlanta. Capital One, welcome to banking reimagined. And from the 2017 AJC Decatur Book Festival, celebrating culinary publishing and hosting chefs, historians, and authors. From barbecue to bourbon, you can explore these sessions and make plans at decaturbookfestival.com. Labor Day weekend, downtown Decatur.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes, speaking with Kathleen Bertrand, the executive producer of the Bronze Lens Film Festival, along with Melina Cunningham Anderson. Her film, Little Music Manchild, made it into the festival this year. Kathleen, what other films are you looking forward to screening?
Well, we will be screening 68 films totally between Wednesday and Sunday, August 23rd through 27th. One that is very timely now is another documentary. It's called Black Suns, an Astrophysics Adventure. And it follows the lives of two African-American astrophysicists who travel the world following eclipses. How timely.
Fancy that.
And you know, who knew at the timing of their entry into the festival that this would all line up?
But, well, the astrophysicists.
But they probably knew it, right? Yeah. They read the stars or something. But we are very excited about having that film because I think it really opens up the eyes of those that attend, and we're really encouraging families to come out and see it, to the fact that there are other careers. Everybody's not going to be a athlete or model or singer, but these gentlemen have really, and one guy started fairly middle class, but the other really had a hard life growing up, and to see where they have come in their lives and what they're doing is not only a beautiful story, but it's quite inspiring as well.
It sounds it.
Yes, we have another film that actually opens the festival. It's called Misguided Behavior, and it's a song you can see where my head always stays. It's a film that really zeroes in on bullying. And the filmmakers want to take this story of two families, two fathers and their sons, and how they deal with the bullying issue. They want to take this on a nationwide platform against bullying. So it's very also timely for what is just kind of going on in society, mean talk and mean behaviors, and how do we we look at that and dissect it in a way that makes life pleasant for everybody. So nobody's the subject of bullying. So we're happy to open with that on Thursday, the 24th of August. In between, we've got also All Day Thursday. It's called All Shorts All Day. And one by one by one, we will be showing 18 short films that have been entered into Bronze Lens. And then the night previously, on August 23rd, it's All Shorts All Night, leading into the next day. And we've got 4 short films that we will be showing on Wednesday night. So lots of films, features, documentaries, webisodes, all during the course of 5 days at Bronze Lens Film Festival.
Melina, as a filmmaker, what do you look forward to most at Bronze Lens?
You know, it's interesting you should ask that, because this is the first time for me being a filmmaker, and this is my first film festival, so I'm actually premiering here. And I want to say thank you to Kathleen for having this vision, for creating this platform, because when I left the news business 13 years ago, I had no idea that I would even think about becoming a documentary filmmaker. And now there are so many platforms out there that need content. I'm really excited about at Bronze Lens, meeting people, networking, learning more about the business of content. Being on the other side, where I was the news anchor, you know, I understand the importance of having content, but I want to get this kind of content out, documentary films, real stories about real people's lives that can affect change in a lot of ways. So thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Bronze Lens. And that's what I'm looking for most. How do I learn more about getting my content out? I think I know how to create it and tell a story. I just want to be able to have the platforms to release it to the public.
It is a multifaceted festival, I yes, have to is. Say. Congratulations.
Thank
Kathleen
you.
Bertrand is the executive producer of the Bronze Lens Film Festival, which kicks off tomorrow. Melina Cunningham Anderson's film Little Music Manchild will screen this Saturday afternoon at 1 at the Auburn Avenue Research Library. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to City Lights. This is a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. You can catch an encore broadcast of City Lights tonight at 8 and tomorrow morning at 11. Emory University professors Matthew Bernstein and Paul Buchholz join us to talk about a new film series at Emory, Resisting Fascism. City Lights is a production of WABE at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. I'm Lois Reitzes. Follow me on Twitter at Lois Reitzes. That's spelled LOISREITZES. The station is at WABE News. That's all for today's edition of City Lights. Thanks so much for joining us and for listening to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.